we would stop desire. And if we stop desire, we would eliminate stress. 4. The way to turn off the mechanism in the brain that causes us to incessantly judge experience as something to approach or avoid is the use of meditation techniques that will ultimately change the way we process reality. Harvard psychologist Daniel Brown, who also happens to be an advanced meditation instructor in the Mahamudra tradition of Tibetan Buddhism, sums it up like this. If you look at your experience moment by moment, if the mind likes something, it moves towards that to make more of it. If the mind doesn't like it, it moves away from that to make less of it. So incessantly the mind is moving towards things and moving away from things. It's reactive. It's built into how we process events moment by moment. And what these meditation practices do is minimize and ultimately eradicate that reactivity. And if you eradicate that reactivity moment by moment so that it just doesn't occur, there is no basis for suffering. Skeptic. Okay, I think I get it. If we eliminate desire, then we won't experience stress. But doesn't that mean we won't experience pleasure either? Doesn't happiness come from satisfying desires? Like, I'm hungry, so I eat a delicious steak. Or, I'm horny, so I plead with my wife to let this be the month we have sex. Answer. I once wondered this too, so I asked Bhante G. He said it's perfectly fine to enjoy pleasures, a sunny day or a nice cup of tea, as long as we don't crave them. The brain has different mechanisms for craving and enjoyment. That's why an addict can still crave his addiction long after he stops receiving pleasure from it. Skeptic. So if we turn off this mechanism that creates desires, we won't just put an end to stress. But will we still be happy? Answer. In Buddhist terminology, the state of having no desires is called nirvana, and it's the highest happiness you can imagine. In his wonderful book, Mindfulness, Bliss, and Beyond, the Buddhist monk Ajahn Brahm tells the story of five children playing the wishing game. The child who came up with the best wish would win. The first child wishes for some chocolate ice cream. The second child bests him by wishing for his own ice cream factory. That way he can have all the ice cream he wants. The third child goes even bigger, wishing for $1 billion. That way, not only could he buy his own ice cream factory, but a candy factory, a toy factory, and whatever else he could buy. The fourth child was a very clever girl, and instead of wishing for something material, she wishes for an unlimited amount of wishes. That way she could have the ice cream, the toy factory, the $1 billion, and whatever else she wanted for the rest of her life. There was no way anyone was going to outdo her wish. Then the fifth child, a shy boy, quietly said, "If I had a wish, I would wish to be so content that I wouldn't need any more wishes." Up until now, we have been content to function as what Dawkins called the survival machines, for the gene's selfish desire to replicate into the next generation. We have been exemplary followers of our genetic overlord's guidance, because as long as we successfully execute their plan, those genes will reward us with health and happiness. But, ironically, if we want to achieve the highest happiness of all, the bliss of perfect contentment, we have to transcend our genetic destiny. We have to change the way we process reality. We have to wake up. What is awakening? Awakening is the cognitive change in how the brain perceives reality. This change leads to the diminishing and eventual cessation of desire. It usually doesn't happen all at once, but occurs incrementally as the subconscious processes special insights into the true nature of reality and how the mind works. The special insights that lead to awakening are that all four of the following beliefs are false. Evolution programmed each of these beliefs into us not because they were true, but because they were beneficial to the replication of the genes residing inside us. For each of these false beliefs, I will tell you the truth, why evolution programmed us this way, and how the truth can set us free, with the traditional Buddhist term in parenthesis. 1. The delusion. The world we see is objective reality. The truth. It's a highly filtered projection of our brains. Emptiness. Reality is merely an illusion, albeit a very persistent one. Albert Einstein. A wise man, recognizing the world is an illusion, does not act as if it is real, so he escapes the suffering. Buddha. The world we see is very different from the objective reality that lies behind it. According to modern physics, our best model for the nature of the universe is quantum field theory. Everything in the universe is made up of fundamental forces and quantum particles. But when we look out at the world, do we see billions upon billions of elementary particles? When we look at water, do we see two hydrogen molecules and one oxygen molecule? No, we do not. We see a clear, liquid substance suitable for drinking and bathing. If our genes had evolved in different survival machines, as they do in other animals, our experience of the world would be vastly different. To understand this, just imagine reality from the point of view of an animal other than ourselves. Human beings can only see a tiny portion of the light spectrum, but some species of snakes, boa constrictors for example, have pit organs on their heads that can sense heat in their surroundings, natural versions of infrared goggles. A snake does not have a sense of taste, but it smells with its tongue. Our ability to hear is rather pathetic compared to that of a dog, which can pick up sound waves far beyond what we can hear. A spider's experience of the world is even more foreign to us. Spiders and humans live in the same world, but because our sense organs are different, we experience the world in a completely different way. Yet spiders and humans are still related. We are distant cousins. An alien species, unrelated to us in any way, may have an experience of reality so dramatically different from ours that it would be beyond our comprehension to even imagine it. The world we see is not the objective world. It is a projection of our own minds. Why evolution programmed us this way? Human beings take in the aspects of the world that our five senses can pick up and filter that information through our brains. Our brain decides which pieces of information are useful for the purpose of survival and replication and turns it all into an output. That output is our conscious experience of the world. The world we experience is a product of our evolution, and what we see is what is highly relevant to our survival. When we look at a tiger, we see a large, powerful cat with sharp teeth who might eat us. We don't see trillions of tiny vibrating strings of energy. Tigers are not objectively real. They are concepts produced by the brains of animals that can see them. How the truth can set us free. If the world that appears to us is a product of the mind, a dreamlike reality created out of the quantum foam, how silly it is to become so attached to it. It is as if you are watching a movie. We know that the movie isn't real, yet we allow ourselves to put this aside and get caught up in the drama that is taking place on screen. We care for the characters, we feel joy when something good happens to them, and jump in fear when the killer suddenly appears brandishing a knife. If we were to snap out of this delusion and realize that we were sitting in a movie theater, watching nothing more than a bunch of pixels on a large screen change color, we would lose all our attachment to the characters and any outcome that befalls them. The same thing occurs when we realize that the world we see is mostly a creation of the mind and is not objectively real. Skeptic. Let's see if I've got this right. There is the outside world of quantum foam or strings of energy or whatever, and our brain takes in data from the senses and creates the reality that I see. This reality consists of trees, other people, cars, but most importantly, my stress. Stress occurs when I take my ex-girlfriend to be this real person and believe that my stories about not being able to live without her are real. After all, if my ex-girlfriend is just a bunch of quantum particles, and I am just a bunch of quantum particles, where is the suffering inherent in that? Stress is not an inherent part of the world. Stress is the delusional creation of my own mind. If I am the creator of my own stress, because I desire objects that are not actually real, then it is possible for me to stop creating my own stress by no longer being so attached to this dreamlike reality. Answer. You got it. 2. The delusion. The external world can satisfy us. The truth. As long as our minds interpret everything through the lens of desire, we will never be totally satisfied. Dissatisfaction. A friend of mine met a beautiful girl when he was 19. She was cute, sweet, fun, and she liked him back. It was not long before he was madly in love. But that summer, his family had a week-long trip planned to the south of France. Before he met this girl, he'd been very excited about this trip. He loved to travel, had a fascination with French culture, and had even studied the language. So was he happy when he stepped into this luxury hotel room overlooking the beach with clear blue waters and battalions of topless women? Did he savor the fine cuisine and vintage wine? Was there a smile on his face as he biked around the cobbled streets and visited the ancient castles? No, he was miserable. He could not stand to be separated from his beloved for even an instant. He was half a world away from her gentle embrace, her lips, her laugh, and her body. It was torture. His inner loneliness made him unable to enjoy the wonders of France. To say that loneliness contaminates experience is not a groundbreaking idea, but I only gave you that example to set you up for the realization that all our experiences, not just trips to France when we are in love, are not completely satisfying. Even in those moments when we think we are at our happiest, we are not completely satisfied. Our greatest romance is tinted with moments of jealousy, anxiety, pain. The next time you are in the throes of passion, examine your mind. You might be surprised to find that even in the heat of the moment, there is a tinge of suffering. This would probably not be the time to blurt this out to your partner, but it's there. Because our brain is perpetually interpreting events moment by moment from the sense of attraction or avoidance, we will never totally be at ease. Why evolution programmed us this way? If we believe that objects in the external world will actually bring us lasting satisfaction, like a pretty girlfriend or a degree from MIT, then we are more likely to try and obtain one. And that was good for our genes. How the truth can set us free. I once asked an expert meditator just how peaceful enlightenment was. He replied that I should imagine a moment in my life where I felt totally at ease. Maybe it was at the top of a mountain overlooking a great valley below. As your meditative skill progresses, everyday life will become just as peaceful. After you reach the early stages of enlightenment, you will look back on the peace you felt on that mountaintop, and it will seem like absolute torment by comparison. The Buddha taught us to be very dissatisfied with normal life. One might think, what a pessimist. But this is only because we haven't realized how much better we could have it. That's one reason it is advised to first reach jhana before beginning insight meditation practices. Once you have reached jhana, a state of mind unhindered by mental afflictions, and seen its enormous joy and bliss, the ordinary world simply can't compare. Even those experiences that we previously considered the most magnificent, from a child being born to a 4-hour Swedish massage, are full of suffering relative to jhana. As long as your mind is tainted by desire, and it always is, there is nothing you can do to be truly satisfied. It doesn't matter how rich we are, how many countries we visit, or how many beautiful people we make love to. We will never be completely satisfied as long as we are caught in the snares of attraction, aversion, delusion. There is only one thing to do. Purify our minds from desire. 1. The delusion that things we desire are permanent and have the ability to bring about permanent happiness. The truth: everything is impermanent. Impermanence. The Buddha noted that a major cause of suffering for people was their vain attempt to hold on to things that don't last. You meet someone and think that this initial love will last forever. You get a job that pays well and spend that money on a new car. Things are looking up. It's happiness from here on out. Until the relationship ends, your car breaks down, and your once steady income stream evaporates. We cling to these things, naively expecting them to stay the same, often in the face of logic and reason. We know damn well we are going to age, but when the inevitable wrinkles form around our eyes and the hairs on our head take on a silver hue, we still get upset and reach for the tweezers. Why evolution programmed us this way. If we hold on to the delusion that love will last forever, it might actually make us more attractive to potential mates. You are far more likely to get laid on your wedding night after a vow that includes, "till death do us part," than if you recited the words, "I'll marry you, but there's a greater than 50% chance that we're going to get divorced and end up hating each other, probably within a decade." How the truth can set us free. When we understand that everything in this universe is impermanent, we stop clinging to things we hoped would never change. We become more comfortable with the fact that our relationships will end, that we will grow old and eventually die. We realize that change is inevitable, so we stop fighting it and just accept it. When we accept it, we become totally attuned to the true nature of the universe, that everything is constantly changing, so we no longer get stressed out when it inevitably does. It is only through false expectations of how the world works that people get disappointed. There is a story about one ancient Stoic philosopher who managed to remain free from grief despite the death of his son. When asked how he accomplished this, he responded, "I never believed my son to be immortal." 4. Delusion. There is a conscious self. The truth. There is no conscious self. No self. And now we come to the commonly misunderstood concept of no self. This is both the most difficult and most important concept to understand in all of contemplative tradition. The idea that what we think of as I is just an illusion. This idea is going to need its own chapter. No self. Skeptic. No self? Are you kidding me? Are you telling me that I don't exist? Answer. What is it that you think you are? Skeptic. Do you see me? Look at me. I am this body, this brain. Think about what you just said. What is it that you think you are? Why would you use the word you if there was no I to hear you? Answer. The terms you and I are being used here as a convenience or a convention. It's the same way that we always refer to the River Thames by the same name, acting as if it is a stable, unchanging entity when it is not. Heraclitus pointed out thousands of years ago that you cannot step into the same river twice. The waters that flow through the river are constantly changing. Similarly, the cells in your body are constantly being replaced. Physically, you are not the same person you were before. Yet, for the sake of convenience, I still refer to you as you. Skeptic. How about this? I am whatever it is that has experiences. I am the thing that feels. I am the thing that thinks. There can't be thoughts without a thinker. Answer. Oh no? Let me tell you the story of Bahia. Back in the time of the Buddha, a ship was asail in the Indian waters when it sprang a leak. All the men on board died and became food for the fishes and tortoises. Skeptic. Tortoises? Seriously? Answer. Yeah, I don't know, but that's how the story goes. Just roll with me here. I'm about to get to the good part. Skeptic. Okay, get to it. Answer. So all the men died except for one, Bahia, who managed to seize a plank and, holding on for dear life, was able to float safely to a nearby port. When he reached land, he was completely naked, so for lack of any better clothing material, he made himself a garment out of twigs and bark. He found himself a begging bowl, and having nothing to eat, went around town seeking alms. The people in the city, seeing his ascetic appearance, figured that he must be a noble mystic, so they filled his bowl with food and treated him with reverence. This life is pretty good, thought Bahia, and he continued his new career as a fake guru. People offered him expensive robes to replace the bark he was wearing, but he refused. He must be a great saint, thought the people, and his fame grew. Being treated with such respect, Bahia came to believe that he was someone special. Then, one day, a deva, an angel-like figure, that wished nothing but wellness for Bahia, came to him and said, "Bahia, you are not an arahant, a fully enlightened being. If you want to be one, you must go and find the Buddha at Savatthi." Bahia traveled straight through the night and arrived in Savatthi the next day. When he got there, the Buddha was on his alms round. Although weary from his journey, Bahia had a keen sense of urgency. He had to see the Buddha immediately. After all, life is fickle, and anyone can be killed at an instant. What horrible luck it would be if Bahia or the Buddha were to die before he could learn the Buddha's teachings. So he went looking for the Buddha. After finding the sage, he threw himself at his feet and asked to hear what the great teacher had to say. "You have come at a bad time, Bahia," said the Buddha. "I am on my alms round. You will have to wait until later." Bahia again begged to be taught, but still the Buddha rebuffed him. He saw that Bahia was too excited just to be in his presence. If he taught him now in this excited state, Bahia would not be able to comprehend what was said to him. He had to make him wait a little. Finally, after Bahia begged him for a third time, explaining that it was a dangerous world, that they could die at any moment, the Buddha relented and offered up the following bit of wisdom. "Then, Bahia, you should train yourself thus. In reference to the seen, there will be only the seen. In reference to the heard, only the heard. In reference to the sensed, only the sensed. In reference to the cognized, only the cognized. That is how you should train yourself. When for you there will be only the seen in reference to the seen, only the heard in reference to the heard, only the sensed in reference to the sensed, only the cognized in reference to the cognized, then, Bahia, there is no you in connection with that. When there is no you in connection with that, there is no you there. When there is no you there, you are neither here nor yonder, nor between the two. This, just this, is the end of stress." Right then and there, Bahia understood completely and became fully enlightened. "May I join your order of monks?" Bahia asked. "First, go and find yourself a robe," replied the Buddha, who then left to continue his alms round. A few moments later, Bahia was gored by a cow and died. Skeptic. "Good story, but clearly I'm not as gifted as Bahia, for I have just heard the exact words that he heard, and yet I am not enlightened. Would you mind running what the Buddha said by me again?" Answer. "No problem. You began by saying that whatever you are, it is that which sees, that which hears, and that which thinks." Skeptic. "Check." Answer. "When the Buddha says that in the seen there is just the seen, in the heard there is just the heard, he denies that very claim. There is not someone who hears, there is just hearing. There is not someone who sees, there is just seeing. There is not someone who thinks, there is just thinking. That which is taken to be you is really just the collection of these aggregates. There is no separate you apart from the thinking, hearing, seeing, feeling, etc. Skeptic. Okay, but I'm not going to take the Buddha's word for it. What do scientists have to say about this? Answer. Scientists are in total agreement. Here is Harvard cognitive psychologist Steven Pinker on the illusion of I. Another startling conclusion from the science of consciousness is that the intuitive feeling we have that there's an executive I that sits in a control room of our brain, scanning the screens of the senses and pushing the buttons of the muscles, is an illusion. Consciousness turns out to consist of a maelstrom of events distributed across the brain. These events compete for attention, and as one process outshouts the others, the brain rationalizes the outcome after the fact, and concocts the impression that a single self was in charge all along. There have been a host of studies to support this. There is simply no ghost in the machine. That feeling you have that there is a specific me is just another feeling arising in your consciousness. It is just another thought that pops up in the field of awareness. It is not a thing that experiences the other objects of consciousness, but just another object of consciousness itself. Skeptic. What do you mean when you say that the self is just another object of consciousness? Answer. We tend to think consciousness works the following way. We have a brain, and that brain produces a self, which in turn has thoughts, feelings, memories, etc. Brain to self to thoughts, feelings, memories, etc. But in reality, we have a brain that produces thoughts, feelings, memories, and a sense of self, etc. This sense of self doesn't have thoughts, feelings, and memories. It is just another collection of thoughts and feelings produced by the brain, and has no special status above other thoughts and feelings. Brain to thoughts, feelings, memories, sense of self, etc. Skeptic. I think I understand intellectually, but I still feel as if there is a me. I still feel as if I am the one who is thinking. Answer. Let's play a game. Let's see if we can get your conscious self to think of something. Sound easy? Okay, quick, think of an animal. What popped into your head? For me, it was a penguin. What about you? Now, why did you choose that animal and not some other animal? How did you come up with that particular animal? Did it just pop into your head? And you aren't really sure why. Who chose that animal? Was it a conscious you? Or did it pop into consciousness from the subconscious? Now, just watch your thoughts and see what thoughts come up. Where did they come from? Who chose those thoughts? Did you choose them? Or did they simply arise from the subconscious? Play around with this and tell me if you can get your consciousness to come up with any thought. Or, do these thoughts always arise from the subconscious? If they always bubble up from the subconscious, what does that say about the idea that there is a conscious self that thinks? One of the meditations used to see no self has the meditator examining each aspect of his experience and then asking, "Is this me? Is the sound I hear me?" Certainly not. Is this feeling of anger me? Is the thought that pops up and then quickly vanishes me? Eventually, the meditator gets so good at it that he can ask questions such as, "Is this awareness me? Is this intention me?" One by one, the meditator knocks down the potential candidates for me until there is nothing left. When one has gone looking for the I and found that it is not there, the feeling that there is an I fades away. Skeptic. It fades away? How is that possible? Answer. Have you ever been in a situation where you had a false belief, and this belief caused you to feel a certain way? Then, when you realize that your belief was false, this feeling evaporated. Let me give you an example. One year on April 1st, my brother, who was in the midst of an action-packed adventure in New Zealand, wrote my mother a short email explaining that he had hurt himself in a bungee jump accident. The cord was too long, and my brother had slammed into the ground, breaking his spine. He was now paralyzed from the waist down. My mother, being a fairly neurotic person, worked herself into such a panic as she read all of this that she fainted, fell out of her chair, and collapsed on the ground before she could ever get to the bottom of the email that read, "April Fools, I'm fine." Finally, after coming to, my mother read the rest of the email and realized her belief that my brother was now paralyzed was false, and subsequently her feeling of horror evaporated. Similarly, when the meditator sees through direct experience that the idea of a separate self, a thinker of thoughts, an experiencer of experience, is but an illusion, then the corresponding feeling of there being a self will also evaporate. Skeptic: how can you function without a conscious self? How can you know anything or do anything? Answer: you never had a conscious self to begin with. You only had the false notion and feeling that you had one. So you can still do all the same things as before. You can still go to work. You can still interact with other people. You can still do your taxes. To understand why, you have to know a little bit about how neuroscientists and cognitive psychologists think the brain and consciousness operate. How consciousness works. The brain is actually divided into dozens of subconscious modules that each perform specific tasks. These include visual modules, auditory modules, thinking modules, emotional modules, and a narrative spinner, a module that sort of sums up what is going on in the brain and concocts a story. The important point here is that all of these modules do their work subconsciously and then project their results into consciousness. Consciousness can be thought of as a screen that other subconscious modules can then see to gather information. In this case, instead of consciousness being a doer or thinker, consciousness is more like a community bulletin board or information exchange, where various subconscious modules can learn what the other modules are up to. To give an example, when you think, "I'm hungry," what is really going on is that one subconscious module decides the body needs nourishment and projects that result into consciousness in the form of a feeling of hunger, so that another subconscious module can see that result and then take action. Perhaps the memory module gets activated and comes to the conclusion, "I have leftovers in the fridge," and projects that information into consciousness, which then gets seen by modules in charge of movement. It is these modules that cause you to get up and walk to the kitchen. At no moment during this quest to get food was there a conscious self making a decision. All the decisions were made by the various subconscious modules. The function of consciousness is merely to integrate these distinct subconscious modules. Skeptic: so if there is no conscious self making decisions or doing much of anything, why is everyone under the illusion that there is? Answer: let me explain. Why evolution programmed us this way. Humans evolved in social groups, and it is the social nature of our species that gave us the illusion of a sense of self. Within our tribe, we had to distinguish between different members. Who was a potential mate, who wasn't, who was a friend, who were our enemies. We gave each other names, we developed the use of the pronouns you and I. We would plan for future actions by imagining ourselves in future scenarios. What will I do the next time Bonga steals my grapes? Somewhere along the way, we got confused into thinking that these pronouns referred to some substance within our skulls that was the conscious self. We then developed egos around this idea of being a self, an image of ourselves that we needed to monitor and constantly critique. Am I well-liked? Am I funny? Should I have said that? These self-referential thought patterns proved useful at augmenting our social status within the tribe, and hence our ability to replicate our genes. How the truth can set us free. I asked Bhante G. why getting rid of the sense of self was beneficial. "Well, I'll tell you," he smiled. "It makes you a lot more humble." He then paused for effect. I could be sitting up here thinking, "Look at me, I am so wise, I have to teach you fools everything." We all laughed. For most people, self-referential narratives are usually not about how great we are, but about how we aren't satisfied with ourselves and our need to impress other people. The most striking thing I've noticed from being around enlightened people is that I get no sense that they care one way or another what I think about them. Not in the sense of, these guys don't give a fuck what I think. In fact, it's exactly the opposite. They tend to exude compassion and benevolence, but they aren't self-conscious. They're totally comfortable with themselves. Self-referential narratives were an adaptation that proved beneficial in passing on our genes, but these narratives remove us from the peacefulness of the present moment. With the desire to maintain a certain image of ourselves, we turn on that mechanism in our brain that constantly judges our behavior in terms of approach, the image we like about ourselves, or avoidance, the image we don't like about ourselves. Whenever our ego is challenged, we suffer. How dare that jerk think that about me? Whenever we aren't living up to our own standards, we suffer. I'm a failure. I'll never be successful. I'm an idiot. How the fuck did I lose to Trump? It's amazing how much time we spend ruminating. When we realize that we aren't a conscious self, we lose our attachments to our thoughts and the stories they weave. Thoughts come up, and then they go. Feelings come up, and then they go. But we don't get attached to them. We don't think, these are my thoughts, my feelings. When seen objectively, these thoughts and feelings don't have the same emotional pull. They may arise, but they don't proliferate. They come and they go. Meditators report that the relaxation that comes from dropping these self-referential narratives is like taking off a heavy backpack after a long hike. There is a wonderful sense of relief that you no longer have to deal with all the bullshit you have been carrying around in your mind all day long. These narratives cause a great deal of stress, perhaps even most of our stress. The Buddha once compared the amount of stress alleviated when getting rid of the false sense of self to the size of a mountain, while the amount of stress that remained was only a few pebbles. Insight Meditation. Now you know the four special insights of awakening. So why don't you feel very enlightened? For the same reason you can't read a book about basketball and then go out to your neighborhood court and shoot like Stephen Curry. Awakening isn't a theoretical knowledge. It's a procedural one. We need to practice. We have to change the way our subconscious interprets reality. We have to get it into our heads, deep within the crevices of our skulls, somewhere amongst that gooey web of neurons and synapses, that the world we see is a subjective model of reality produced by our brains. Nothing within it, not the people, not the objects, not our ideals and ideas, not even ourselves, are worth clinging to. How awakening happens in the brain. During our normal distracted state of mind, the various subconscious modules in the brain compete for attention. One module will go, "Hey, I feel like eating chocolate cake." And another will reply, "No, remember we are trying to eat paleo." Eventually, one wins out. And, since you have been listening to this book, hopefully it's the latter. But when we are in a deep state of concentration, our subconscious modules become unified towards a common goal. This unification means that instead of bickering among each other, the subconscious modules will be attentive and receptive to any insights we might have. This allows our new insights to penetrate down into the subconscious and bring about the radical change in the way we process reality. Awakening happens when we combine very deep concentration, one should be able to reach jhana, with lots of deep insight. We've already learned how to practice concentration, but how do we practice insight? The practice. The first people to awaken did so by accident. Shinzen Young, the meditation teacher who has spent time with native tribes, theorizes that some shamans may have stumbled upon enlightenment after a lifetime of getting themselves into deep states of trance and developing equanimity, having neither approach nor avoidance reactions, towards the grueling physical toll of many day-healing rituals. The Buddha's great contribution is that he may have been the first to figure out a systematic way to enlightenment. There are many ways of doing insight practice within Buddhism. In the Tibetan tradition of Mahamudra, the student describes his experiences to the teacher, and then the teacher in turn points out insights to the student, asking, "Have you looked at it like this?" In Zen, the teacher asks the student nonsensical questions called koans to pop the student out of his conceptual way of thinking. Questions such as, "What is the color of the wind?" When the student inevitably gets the answer wrong, the master hits him with a stick. If he gets it wrong twice, the master cuts his nuts off. Just making sure you are still paying attention. I am not a Tibetan Lama, nor do I have a stick to beat you with. So instead, I'll refer you to a practice called noting. It has the advantages of simple instructions and can be practiced by yourself anywhere at any time, which allows you to make gains very quickly. The technique. As when doing concentration practice, start by following the inhalation and exhalation of the breath. Do this for a little while until your mind settles down and you feel calm and focused. Distractions will come up, but instead of ignoring them and returning to the breath as we did before, switch your focus to the distraction, say a thought, and note thinking. A pain in the knee comes up, note pain. A tingling sensation, note tingling. If you notice something in your visual field, seeing. Do not worry about being exact with your words, nor should you try to note more than one thing at a time. Just apply a general label, say it once or twice, drop it, and move on to the next sensation that occurs. If after noting something and nothing else comes up, then return to the breath until the next distraction appears. This technique also has the advantage of being able to be practiced all day long, which is especially helpful while on retreat. As you get up from your cushion and go about the day, the noting practice continues. Note standing, walking, turning, chewing, seeing, lifting. The idea is to maintain a constant and vigilant meta-level awareness to all your activities. There is debate among meditators whether one needs to label each note by silently saying thinking, feeling, etc., or if you can just be aware of thinking without needing to label it with a word. Again, as in most things involving meditation, experiment with both and see what is best for you. Most practitioners find labeling each distraction with a silent word useful, at least until concentration is very strong, at which point the sensations are so fine and come so fast that it is best not to bother with labeling. Just mentally take notice. By noting each sensation, you are training your mind to realize impermanence, dissatisfaction, and no self. When you note feeling and then watch it vanish, you are noticing the impermanence of that feeling. You realize that this feeling can't possibly bring lasting satisfaction, and is hence unsatisfactory. As you note all the various parts of the body and mental stream, you realize that none of these sensations are you. What you thought was a single permanent self is really just a bundle of vibrating thoughts, feelings, and sensations. When you realize the impermanence, dissatisfaction, and no self in all the phenomena that make up experiential reality, you realize the futility in grasping onto them. You let go. You relax. You become free. Skeptic. Okay, so if I master these concentration and insight practices, I will eventually awaken. But how will I know when that happens? Is there a specific moment when I can declare that I am awakened? Answer. All the meditative traditions have their own criteria for awakening, and they rarely agree with each other. This is because awakening exists on a continuum. Any attempt to draw a line in the sand and say, "Now I am awakened," is purely conceptual. What's more important is to notice how over the course of time that your approach and avoidance mechanisms have dialed down, that you are more content with reality to be just as it is, and that your stress levels have dropped. Whether anyone has ever fully awakened, that is, completely eliminated all forms of mentally created stress, I am agnostic about. But what is possible is to reduce your stress levels and achieve a sense of deep peace far beyond what you ever thought possible. Skeptic. That sounds real nice and all, but I don't know, man. I'm still unsure about this. The part about losing your sense of self, that sounds a bit scary. I'm just not sure it's worth it. Answer. Awakening does not come without the price of admission. You will stop caring so much about your current passions. You may even have odd experiences in your meditation that will be unnerving. It can be scary to truly let go, although once you do, you will realize there is nothing to fear. Some meditators have described this feeling as jumping off a cliff, only to realize they could fly. Still, having a teacher to guide you through any potential rough patches, to bounce questions off of, to help elucidate the nuances of the path, is highly recommended. You won't fully get over these doubts until you see the benefits from first-hand experience. Right now, you might even doubt that awakening is desirable. This is normal. People have had these doubts for thousands of years. Doubts that the writers of the suttas tried to quell with this legendary parable about the Buddha. Once there was a young monk named Nanda, who one day went to the Buddha and said, "I'm done with a holy life. I want to return to being a normal person." The Buddha asked why, and the young monk said that he had met a girl from Sakya, the most beautiful in the land, with long flowing hair. Just then, the Buddha grabbed the young monk by the arm, and they magically left the world they were in and flew to a heavenly realm where there were 500 pink-footed nymphs. "What do you think, young monk? Are these 500 pink-footed nymphs more alluring than that girl from Sakya, the prettiest in the land?" asked the Buddha. "Revered sir, compared to these 500 pink-footed nymphs, that Sakyan girl, the loveliest in the land, is like a mutilated she-monkey that has had its ears and nose chopped off. She does not count. She is not worth a fraction compared to them. There is no comparison. These 500 nymphs are far more beautiful, more fair to behold, and more alluring." "Rejoice, Nanda! Rejoice, Nanda! I guarantee that you will obtain 500 pink-footed nymphs if you follow my instructions." "If, revered sir, the Lord guarantees that I will obtain 500 pink-footed nymphs, I shall be content in living the holy life under the Lord." Nanda practiced and practiced, hoping to get those 500 nymphs. Then, one day, after some very intense practice, Nanda reached a state where he felt so content that the present moment was just perfect as it was. Nothing could make it any better. He went to the Buddha and told him that his mind was now taintless, and that the Buddha no longer had to uphold his promise to give him 500 nymphs, as he had no desire for them anymore. Skeptic. Okay, I get it. Awakening is better than being rich. It's better than the high of a drug. It's better than having a harem of 500 pink-footed nymphs. And not only does awakening feel better than these worldly pleasures, It's stable. I can lose my job, get divorced, develop elephantitis, and still be happy. If all this is true, to live my life any other way would be madness. 6. Integration. Fusion. The Homo sapiens animal is a handful of stardust that has become conscious of itself, a fact more incredible than all the creation myths of the ancient religions. Within us, we have a genetic program complete with desires, emotional reactions, pleasures, and pains, all united in the task of getting microscopic strands of DNA to fuse with one another, and then repeat the process when the next generation comes of age. When we follow our genetic blueprint, we are one of the lucky species that will experience happiness. But modern life is so vastly different from the environment in which our genes originally evolved that our body's response to the social isolation, traffic, bills, long working hours, concrete jungles, and lack of meaning has placed our body in a state of chronic stress. Constantly on edge, we are quick to anger, to feel anxiety and worry. We become depressed. We don't sleep well. To combat our lack of sleep, we take stimulants to give us energy, and then drink booze to take the edge off. The natural insouciance of the human animal is gone. Yet, not all hope is lost. By taking a multifaceted approach, we can turn off this perpetual stress signal and return to the carefree ways of our ancestors. We have to tackle the environmental stressors on our body and return to a nutritional and movement lifestyle reminiscent of our ancestors. By feeding our bodies a healthy diet of nutritious whole foods, complete with fresh fruits and vegetables, and heaps of quality meats, we are giving our body the fuel it needs to function well. Most importantly, we will avoid the disease, depression, and inability to focus that results from dopamine depletion. And dopamine depletion is caused by sugary, processed foods. We must remain vigilant against the inactivity, sitting, lethargy, and passive entertainment that contemporary culture tries to force upon us. We need to run around in the sun, lift heavy things, and move in agile ways until our hearts thump in our chest and we high-five our teammates in victory. By doing this, our bodies will be fit, live, sexy, and disease-free. All this activity calls for rest, and it is vitally important that we get quality sleep. So many of us don't adhere to the circadian rhythms that our mammalian bodies have adapted to over the course of millions of years. We shouldn't need to take sleeping pills to pass out or drink copious amounts of caffeine to wake up. It is possible to fall asleep naturally in a relaxing slumber and awaken with the energy needed for the pursuits of the day. The songs of birds, the rustling of leaves, the soothing sounds of a flowing creek. For thousands of generations, this was the soundtrack to our lives. Today, it has been replaced by the stress-producing cacophony of car horns, jackhammers, police sirens. We must make frequent escapes from the smog and pollution out into the fresh air of natural habitats. Turn off the cell phone. Leave the iPad at home and trek into the wilderness. Splash around in streams. Breathe in the aroma of the forest. Notice how the act of disconnecting yourself from the constant barrage of texts, emails, tweets, and Facebook updates gives you a sense of peace and calm. Your batteries will be recharged. Your focus will improve. Deep down inside, your body knows that you are a large primate and that the wild is your true home. We have to reconnect to the tribe. So many people today feel lonely, isolated, lacking the deep communal bonds that united our tribal ancestors. Many of the positive emotions we experience today evolved to facilitate cooperative relationships between people. We should make an effort to improve our relationships with family members, to spend more time with friends, and join groups of people that will influence us in positive ways. That could be your local CrossFit box, a dance group, or a Buddhist Sangha. Even Buddhist monks, who are often thought to be solitary loners, prefer the company of like-minded friends. One day, Ananda, the Buddha's first cousin and one of his most respected disciples, sat down next to the Buddha and said, "This is half of the holy life, Lord. Admirable friendship, admirable companionship, admirable camaraderie." The Buddha looked at his cousin and replied, "Don't say that, Ananda, don't say that. Admirable friendship, admirable companionship, admirable camaraderie is actually the whole of the holy life." If we were to do just these five things, eat right, get fit, sleep well, be in nature, and develop good relationships, there is a good chance that we would live happy and healthy lives. Of course, we would not be immune to things that are beyond our control, and we could never perfectly recreate the environmental conditions of the original hunter-gatherer lifestyle. We need more tools if we hope to live as placidly, as fully in the present existential moment as they did. This is where mind training comes in. The first step is to break away from our habitually negative thought patterns. Instead of obsessing over every little setback or roadblock, we will learn to find the silver lining. We will learn to think rationally and adopt the motto, "If there is a solution to the problem, there is no need to worry." And if there is no solution to the problem, worrying won't solve it. So why bother worrying? We will accept the positivity challenge and refuse to rest until we have succeeded. From there, we will work on calming and focusing our mind with concentration meditation exercises. We will do metta practices to develop a mind that is more compassionate, joyful, and infused with benevolent goodwill. We will refine our attention until we achieve the states of jhana, a natural ecstasy without side effects, that is available to us whenever we decide to sit down on the cushion. Finally, we will do insight meditation to examine the nature of conscious experience more accurately. We will discover experientially how our beliefs that we are a separate self, that things are permanent, and that things will satisfy us are mere delusions that cause suffering. We will realize the emptiness of phenomena by seeing that the world we cling to so passionately is at best a highly filtered projection of the mind. And with this, we will stop wanting the world to be any different than it is. From then on, we will live in sublime peace. This is the path laid out in this book. For ultimate well-being, we need to fuse the Paleolithic lifestyle with Buddhist meditation. One without the other is incomplete. Without meditation, the modern person living a paleo lifestyle will never experience the profound joy and insight of the serious meditation practitioner. On the other hand, someone who solely meditates won't have the physical health and vitality of one who exercises, sleeps, and eats the paleo way. One of the most respected Tibetan Buddhist masters of the last century, Tulku Urgyen Rinpoche, suffered from diabetes. Other highly enlightened folks I've talked to have mentioned that they could be happier if their jobs allowed them a more natural sleep cycle or if they exercised more. Awakening does not mean that your mammalian body has become immune to biological stressors. It is with the fusion of a paleo lifestyle and Buddhist meditation that we can become as happy and healthy as humanly possible. This short, precious life. The vast majority of people who buy this book will not make it past the first chapters. If you are one of the minority, one of those people who have listened through and made it to the finale, I congratulate you. Still, most of you will finish this book, set it down, and go on living your lives just as you lived them before. That is why I am ending this book about health and happiness with an important reminder. You are going to die. If you are lucky, it will be decades from now when you finally slip away peacefully in your sleep. If you are unlucky, you could find out that you have terminal cancer tomorrow. Or you might be on your way to work when a teenager smashes her SUV into you because her text, "OMG, cutest cat picture ever," simply couldn't wait. Death can happen in an instant. If you were to die today, How would you feel about your life? Close your eyes and